And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast live on a Monday morning where I'm thrilled to be joined by the individual who I think is closest to being at the exact intersection of NBA basketball and professional sports and social justice movements. And that's the head coach of the Atlanta Hawks, Mr. Lloyd Pierce. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Let's get the fun stuff out of the way first. How was Father's Day in the Pierce household with your wife and your beautiful daughter?
Relaxing. Yeah, we went to Piedmont Park here in the city and had a social distanced, relaxing day. Brought some lawn chairs out, brought the Sonos Move and had a little music and let my little 2-year-old run around with some space.
And, there you go.
You know, it was good. Just good times. Weather was nice. Had a nice little breeze. Exactly what we needed.
Did they get you anything? Did you get?
Yeah, I got some, what do you call these things? The AirPods.
Okay, AirPod sure.
Pros.
Nice. Very
and,
nice.
I got a nice little picture book that my wife created of me and my daughter for her first 22 months of existence.
Yeah, she's turning two soon, right?
Turning two in August, yeah.
I remember a couple summer leagues ago, you were in the hot zone. It was about to happen, and
yeah,
now you got a crazy toddler running around your house,
right?
And protesting with you. I've seen the photos you've taken.
Yeah, no, she walks around the house whenever she sees the sign. She just walks around the house and says, "No justice, no peace." That's kind of her line. So
that's
pretty.
Great. So You obviously have many reasons personally, professionally, to be passionate about this, all of these issues before George Floyd. George Floyd happens and you immediately sort of take a leadership role, both among NBA coaches and in the community of Atlanta with your players. And then, as you've talked about recently, this goes from a national issue to a hyper local one for Atlanta with the killing of Rayshard Brooks. And then, the election day disaster. From, I can't remember if it was last Tuesday or the Tuesday before, where it takes everybody, particularly in minority communities, forever to vote. The machines don't work. There's allegations of voter suppression. All of a sudden, you are both the head coach of a basketball team that needs to be ready to compete next season. And at you know, it's Atlanta and Minneapolis that I think are now the epicenters of everything that's going on. And with voting becoming a critical issue and the focus on Georgia as a battleground state in the 2020 election, you're going to be at the epicenter of this for a long time now. So do you feel – you've talked eloquently about how you feel a responsibility to keep this discussion going. Is it almost hard for you to think about, like, how am I going to fit John Collins and Clint Capella on the court? Do you almost feel like that like thinking about basketball is like almost dereliction of duty at this point?
No. You know, and I think, you know, it's one of those moments where – you know, especially with our local media, I think they probably understand what I've been saying all along a little bit clearer now. You know, I often say I'm really focused on our players' maturity and growth more so than the next game versus the Boston Celtics. I think that's an easy way to say I'm coaching the team. We ran this play tomorrow and it's going to be great. And all of a sudden we're here. We've arrived. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way in sports. And, you know, when you look at championship caliber teams and you look at the makeup of the individuals that are on that team and in that organization, the makeup is built on character and high IQ, guys that are willing to commit and sacrifice for others before themselves. You don't just develop that. You know, it's great to put a cast of talent together. Then what? You know, you just don't win. You win because of the sacrifice, the commitment, the work ethic, the character, and the competitiveness. But I've said that all along, and I've tried to say that all along. And even when I always say I don't criticize our players publicly. That's not me. I don't, you know, that's not character. That's not high character. And that's not what I want to exemplify. And so this thrust into this role makes it easier, actually, I think, for me to communicate with our players, because now they see me. I'm telling them to use their voice on the court. I'm telling them to use their voice in the locker room. They see me using my voice. There's no gray line of whether or not Coach Pierce will stand up or say something or do something. They see it. So when I ask them to do it, they understand exactly what I mean. On the basketball side, and I've always said that the X's and O's, you know, if I'm being evaluated by my X's and O's, that's, to me, that's the Monday morning quarterback, you know, that you talk about. You know, it's what you put into it and how you prepare your men for the game that really you should be evaluated by. Are they organized? Are they committed? Do they play hard? That's the preparation side.
How have you tried to prepare both yourself and your players? And I think you're in a particularly interesting position because, like a lot of NBA coaches, you have primarily black players on your team, but also very young players who can speak to younger fans and in a lot of cases maybe just sort of learning about the more academic side of these issues. So how have you thought about, you know, you're not going to be together as a team playing basketball till December. How have you thought about making sure this discussion and all of these discussions remain tier one priority, remain in the news, remain a part of your life and their lives until December? And you had a great quote about this in some article I was reading. You said, you know, this is particularly important for Atlanta. We're a majority black city, proud tradition of black entrepreneurship, black political participation. You said, we can't be last here. We can't even be second. Like, we got to be first, right?
Well, I think the biggest thing is understanding I can't make this a priority for someone else. And I saw a quote that said something about it. You can't make someone care for others. What you can do is educate them about the situation at hand and why people are protesting or why this feeling is different, this motion and movement is different than that of the past, because it's ours. And as a younger generation, this is their civil rights. This is their, whatever era you want to refer back to, this is their time. And, you know, some people protested in the civil rights movement and some people didn't. And you're going to have differing opinions. I think it's hard to be passionate about it if you're not educated. You go out there and someone puts a mic in your face, well, why are you out here? And you don't know what to say. You don't want to feel like you're unprepared or you're not ready for the moment. You're just being a follower. And so it isn't my job to force passion upon our players or anyone else. It is my job to just try and keep the conversation alive and to educate our players on why I'm doing what I'm doing and kind of what's going on. But again, we do that a lot. We've done that a lot. We try and educate our guys about the city, the history of the city, understand that you play in Atlanta. And what I talked about is this isn't the normal city in America, especially for an African-American. We have one white player on our team. That's Kevin Herter. And I've been as proud of any of our guys with Kevin, you know, because of his ability to say, this is uncomfortable and I'm going to find a way to be comfortable and be in the fight. And he's been tremendous in doing so. You know, he came to the protests. He joined in a Zoom conversation that we had with some Falcons players to address him finding his voice.
I was going to ask specifically about him because he is the only white player in your team. And to me, sports is the greatest laboratory, one of the great laboratories in the world for eradicating racism. And basketball, I just don't know. I like any white basketball player should view racism as something that is just not only untenable, but like, how can you be? Because you're introduced from a young age to people from all cultures. So I was going to, but I can picture Kevin Herter thinking, oh boy, I'm the only white guy on our team. What's my place here? What should I do? Do I listen? Do I engage in conversations? I was going to ask. So you brought it up. So what is it? What have those conversations been like with him? Has he been asking questions like, what should I do? Or has he just dove headlong into like, I'm with you guys. What do you want me to, what can I do?
No, and I say this to anybody, myself included. Listen, first thing you do is listen. You show empathy, you listen. You know, joining someone else means you think someone else has the answers. I don't have the answers. I'm listening and I'm being educated and I'm trying to be educated. The thing with our committee is we've been able to be in contact with some of the most profound and deeply rooted advocacy agents and leaders that are proposing change. And so we've been educated by...
This is the coaches committee you're talking
about?
Yeah.
But I say that because that's what I'm doing. I'm listening and I'm trying to listen. I'm trying to be educated. So I think Kevin's done a tremendous job and he's admitted that of trying to be educated about something that he really had no knowledge of that was as deeply rooted as it is. You know, you get your history lessons and then there's just that little sample size. And he's saying, wow, you know, I didn't know you wake up thinking this, or you go to the mall feeling like this. Or when you're driving on a highway, you see a police officer, this is what triggers your thoughts.
Well, you talked about this. You said, you know, I'm the coach of the Hawks. I'm one of 30 NBA coaches in the world. All right. It's a big deal. I'm the coach of the Atlanta Hawks. I'm also a 6'3 black guy. I walk around wearing a t-shirt that says ATL on it. I'm walking down the street. I don't look like the coach of the Atlanta Hawks necessarily. I just look like a guy on the street, right? I mean, like, and for you to say that, it sounds so obvious, but it has very profound meaning to you, right? I mean, it's like, it's not like I wear a sign that says Lloyd Pierce, head coach of the Atlanta Hawks.
I mean, you know, if I go to New York, I'm not Lloyd Pierce, head coach of the Atlanta Hawks. I'm just a black dude walking through New York. You know, some places in Atlanta, I can walk around and somebody say, hey, there goes Coach Pearson. But it's not, in my mind and how I approach life is I'm not famous. I'm not, you know, this guy that everyone knows. But I am black and I am intimidating. You know, if you're of the intimidated type, I am intimidating. And, that's the most concerning part. And it's understanding that is why, as a black man, you understand your defense mechanisms. You understand your appropriate responses to any and all situations that could put you in a compromised position as a black man, as we've seen thus far.
One of the things that's so challenging about all these issues is that they seem so big as to be impossible to tackle. Georgia holds its primary elections and it's a disaster, and it's particularly a disaster in black communities. And one idea that I don't know who within the Hawks pitched it, but you have given public voice to it is, okay, so here's one concrete idea. Can we make our arena a polling place? Can we organize it? Can we make sure that it's a place that the community can come vote in a quick and orderly fashion where everyone is trained properly? Can we take some ownership of it? What have you learned about the feasibility of that? Is that idea still? And you said, why don't we do this in every city? Why don't we make every NBA? And I thought that's a great idea. And I say that's a great idea, and then my brain goes to, I haven't even started to think about the 4,000 bureaucratic steps between now and making that idea a thing that can happen.
Yeah, it's. I think it was our CEO Steve Koonin who first pitched the idea, and obviously I've been able to just throw it out there, and it's been well received as an idea. And I think there's some legs to it. I think there's an opportunity. You know, one of the members who I work with closely on our staff, Erica Hill, she kind of assists me in everything that I do, connecting me to the city and everyone in the city. She's on a committee here in the city of Atlanta where this is what they're talking about. You know, how can they make that a reality? In addition to our G League facility, which is in College Park, which is in South Atlanta, which is predominantly African American. So it's not just our arena. It's our G League arena as well. So now we've got two, you know, massive facilities that can handle a large capacity of voters. And one of the things she's learned is it's not so much about using that facility on election day. It's really about early voters. Opening that facility for 7 to 10, 10 to 14, I think there's a window that they're trying to figure out, and then having early voters be able to come in and, you know, and within that, you know, how do you staff it? You know, using our employees using corporate employees to staff it, and not just, you know, there's been a lack of volunteers, and there's older volunteers, and whatever the case may be, you know, resurging that part of it, so we don't have understaffed volunteers throughout the election early voting process. And so there's ideas that are being worked on. I think there's a 25 member committee here in the city that's focused on that, that's working with the Secretary of State, I believe it is, to get this done. But it's got legs, and you know that's where we are here in Georgia. I'm sure it's a greater task to get all 30 cities, but you know, as you see in Kentucky, they've used the coronavirus as a way to limit and shrink the polling sites. So it's needed. It's not just needed here in the state of Georgia. It's needed everywhere.
Well, that's the one that we can't shut up on any of these issues. They're all profoundly important. And there is a right or wrong side to be on for all of them. But the voting one is like, if we can't get voting right, the whole thing falls apart. That's it.
That's the definition of suppression. Someone doesn't want us to get voting right. Someone wants to restrict the ability to vote for the young, for the people of color, for the old, for the disabled, you know, for those that have been released from prison and, you know, are in the probation system, but not in incarcerated. You know, that's by design. That's by design to restrict those individuals from having access, you know, location and things of that nature. I'm learning so much. Exact match in terms of your identity and your name and how it's, you know, all of those things. And then there's intimidation factor. So that's all by design. There's no coincidence. It's all by design. And it's just unfortunate.
Well, and it's been all by design for the majority of American history. And right. And a Supreme Court ruling, people can go look it up, 7 years ago, undid a lot of good that had been directed right. at solving those issues, particularly in the South. And voter ID laws are, you know, a friend of our family's worked closely on a case in Wisconsin about voter ID laws there. So it's not just in the South, it's everywhere. Trey Young is part of LeBron's, the voting rights project that LeBron and Skylar Diggins, have you spoken to him about his involvement of that? And you were on Cleveland's coaching staff when LeBron was there. Are you involved? You're not on the list of names that's attached to that, but are you involved in that at all?
No, I am, trying to get involved, and I've spoken to, I believe his name is Adam Mendelson, who is one of the key figures on the More Than a Vote campaign. LeBron passed my number to Adam, and Adam reached out. And we've had a couple conversations about what we can do with the Coaches Association to partner up or just kind of assist whatever capacity, you know, if it's lending a name, lending all of our names, or just doing simultaneous work. But we've been in contact, and, you know, he mentioned how they were able to connect Trey with the New York Times writer to really talk about his role with regards to More Than a Vote. And that's the biggest thing. It's using the athletes in their respective cities to generate interest, to generate buzz of being registered voters, being educated voters, and then participating in that voting on election day. And that's what I think the More Than a Vote is that's their calling card, is their ability to reach, especially the fan base that they have, which are the younger voters, African-American voters, voters of color, a different generation of voters that are voting for the first time or really not interested in voting and just trying to, you know, make it cool to vote. Basically, how can young athletes make it cool to vote for young next generation individuals?
It's obviously, you know, that speaks to something you talked about, I think, very eloquently about. So that's a concrete action. That's using your platform to donate money, to inspire a specific action, because you're not going to the bubble in Orlando. The Hawks are a non bubble team. Everyone is sort of, it's so easy in the media to become fixated on, well, are they going to kneel during the anthem? What is the means of protest going to be? What's the symbolism going to be? Are they going to do this? You had a great soliloquy in one of the articles I was reading about how you can't, like, that stuff the moment that that takes precedence in the coverage is the moment that we in the media have made a mistake. That the issue can't be, what are they going to do? Does it work? How does it look? How powerful is it? It has to be the actions that are underneath it, right? I mean, I'm putting words in your mouth, but I thought what you said was very eloquent, because we do fall into the trap of, oh, are they going to enforce the anthem rule? Oh, who's going to kneel? Is LeBron going to kneel? Is it, and like that stuff? It matters, but it's not, it doesn't matter. It's not the real stuff, right?
Right. And you know, I've avoided debate, you know, and I can see the question coming a mile away. I'm doing an interview and I don't care who it's with. You know, there's talks about the, you know, if athletes, when football or basketball resumes, you know, would you support someone kneeling? And so that's the question. And then the answer of just that is the topic. That's the headline.
That's it.
You know, I hate headlines because it doesn't tell the true story.
And you got to call in, go ahead and kneel, exclamation
right,
point.
Right. And so I said, I always say, I will continue to support anyone that wants to continue keeping this conversation alive, regardless of what act. So if it's a kneel, it's a fist. But that's the most important thing, is to not get away from what the individual is speaking out against or speaking up about, whatever the issue is, voting, racial profiling, racial bias, whatever the case may be. I support them continuing that conversation. And I don't care how they go about doing it. You know, I think it's up to the individual. Some people protest, some people march, some people do it social media, whatever the case may be. I support those that are willing to keep the conversation going.
Have you spoken to Renee Montgomery, who plays for the Atlanta Dream but is sitting out the season?
You know, not about sitting out. She actually invited me. We follow each other on Instagram, and she invited me to assist her. She was doing something on Juneteenth where she was mm-hmm. handing out waters to the protesters and things of that nature. But she reached out and invited me, and I couldn't do it because I was doing a podcast or a panel for John Lewis's movie that's coming out July 5th. But I haven't been in contact with her. I meant to hit her like a real response to applauding her for being passionate about it. But I do. I applaud her. That's a big step.
You mentioned this in a story in The Athletic that I read shortly after George Floyd was murdered. I don't know why all those words together were tough for me to say. And just about everyone sort of having to have these discussions. And I wonder if you could elaborate on a little bit. You said Kenny Atkinson sent you an email about the pain he had been holding in about Tabo Cephalosha having his leg broken at the hands of police brutality when Kenny was an assistant with the Hawks. I couldn't quite tell from the story, but it seemed like the pain for him was, had he done enough either publicly or privately to support Tabo? So tell me about that email and like sort of what it meant to you or what it signified about Kenny, and particularly about white coaches who still are the majority of coaches in the NBA and the platforms that they have, not only publicly, but privately behind the scenes with their players.
Yeah. You know, I think Kenny was just showing vulnerability of a situation that he knew about. He felt bad for Tabo. And I don't want to put too much into what he said. And you know, I've done enough sharing what he said. But to me, it was just showing empathy for the severity of everything that's going on, and specifically to something that he was involved with someone he knew. I think in general, because I've received more texts in the last 3 weeks from my white coaching friends and white friends, expressing similar thoughts. And, you know, the biggest thing, and this is for white and black, and I heard a great quote that said, unmute your feelings. There's no need for you now to just feel it and then not say anything about it. And then, you know, harness that regret in for as long as Kenny expressed, or as many people will express. You know, you're now hearing stories about, I had a black friend that I grew up with and I never quite understood it. And, you know, we were in this incident and they just targeted him. That was 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago. And those feelings are still in there. So that unmute your feelings means you know right from wrong. You're seeing what's happening. Speak up. This isn't, and this is, you know, this is why they say this is a white person problem. This is a white problem. Blacks have been fighting for blacks for a long time on this issue. And, you know, those that understand it and have been sympathetic about, you know, Black Lives Matter in our country and the racial divide, now are being called to action as well. And I think this is where you have to unmute your feelings and start finding your voice and using your voice and being part of the solution.
Speaking of unmuting your feelings, I wanted to see if you remembered this. Of all the background reading I was doing about you and the Hawks in the last 6 weeks, one story that I hadn't heard really struck me, and I wonder if you remember it. A ticket sales associate with the Hawks in her first year with the team, after George Floyd was murdered, wrote a company-wide email or something expressing, I think her name was Sherry, expressing rage at what had happened and sort of just like letting all the emotions come out in an email. And from what I had read, sort of saying, we have to do something here. We have to come together as an organization. We have to have a town hall and decide next steps forward. And I read that thinking, boy, oh boy, I don't know. Maybe she's super accomplished in another field and pivoted into a first year job at age 45 or something. But I read first year and I was like, that takes some guts as a first year on the job to like be like, no, I'm angry and we have to address it as a team. And it takes some faith in the broader organization's culture to receive that email in the way it was intended to be received and to act on it. So do you know what I'm talking about? And what do you remember the email? And like, what was your, do you know her? And like, what was your reaction? Because I read that and I was like, that's pretty damn gutsy.
No, I mean, a lot of the employees reach out in different, you know, I'm on every social media site. So LinkedIn is the one she forwarded the email to me. I think I had done a town hall with our organization a week before, or actually I was on like a Monday roll call. So a lot of the employees reached out and thanked me for being on there. And she was one. And then kind of like as a, oh, by the way, you know, once the George Floyd incident occurred, I sent this to our CEO and other execs. I want to forward it to you. And it floored me because, you know, it was an African-American employee saying, I feel a little powerless and voiceless. What can I do? What are we going to do? So it was a call for help. And it was a call to say, I want to do something. I don't know if I can. I don't know if I should, but I'm going to say it anyways, which is courageous and which is brave on her part. But for me, it was, I can do something and I can say something. Am I going to? And that was, you know, kind of a moment of truth. And, you know, in a lot of ways sparked a lot of what I've done up to this point, which is, bring it to our, I went right to Tony Ressler and, he and I had a very candid conversation and the conversation was based on how I felt that week. And, you know, I've said it a million times. It wasn't George Floyd. That was my tipping point. I read something today that Carmelo talked about. His tipping point was the young man in Baltimore a couple of years back. I can't remember his name right now.
Freddie Brown.
You know, that's his area. That's where, you know, Melo's from that area. And that was kind of his call to action. His tipping point for me was Amy Cooper. I just, you know, you've seen the police brutality. You've seen African-American men be targeted. You've seen racial profiling, some leading to death, some not. I hadn't seen the weaponizing. I hadn't seen the strategizing of white privilege saying, I have white privilege. I'm going to show you I have white privilege. And here it is. I hadn't seen that on camera before. And so that was my tipping point. That was the momentum. That was when I expressed it. I get the email from Sherry. I call Tony. I call Rick Carlisle and David Fogle and say, we as coaches have to do something. Like, it all kind of just went from there. And I'm glad it did.
The Amy Cooper thing in a way, reminds me of the media issues I talked about with the kneeling, because those videos surface and it's so easy to just sort of like, oh, look at this hysterical woman, and just make it like a, let's humiliate her. Let's humiliate the hysterical woman. And by the way, all for humiliating her. That's all. Her behavior is awful. It's embarrassing. But you are one of the first people in sports that I saw to say, no. It's not just about humiliating the hysterical woman. Guys, do you realize that there's a direct line from Amy Cooper to George Floyd? I'm going to trace that line for you. And when you said that in the media, I think it hit a lot of people like, oh, this isn't just a story of a hysterical, angry, bitter white woman calling the police on this guy who's birding. It's literally on the continuum to George Floyd. It's how George Floyd happens. And I think for you to articulate that right away was very, very powerful within NBA circles.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary. And I think it's scary in a sense that was so powerful for me on Sunday to watch Amy Cooper, Christian Cooper, Sunday night have that exchange. And then literally the next morning, wake up to the George Floyd, I think it was a holiday, the George Floyd incident just goes, and it's like A to B is how it all unfolds. And then you just think of how many black men have been fired, how many black men have been arrested, how many black men have been harassed because of an accusation. And when you really dig into the history, and I just came back from Montgomery, Alabama on Tuesday visiting the Legacy Museum that Brian Stevenson has created. And it talks about the lynchings in the United States up until 1950. And you just go through and you read, you know, this man was lynched because he didn't address an officer with Mr. in front. So you see, like, you see the history. This isn't, Amy Cooper isn't the first. She was the most visible in modern day. But this is history repeating itself, and just showing us how to do it with modern technology and in today's age. And it's, you know, you grow up reading about lynchings, and you grow up reading about, you know, being whipped. You grow up reading about all these different things, and you're like, no way I could have lived in that generation. Well, we're living in that generation right now. It's just different. It just looks different.
It's a couple more and I'll let you go, because I do want to ask a couple of basketball questions. But I just think to hear you speak, I think people who knew you when you were younger kind of smile as they see you take on a leadership role, because, you know, Santa Clara's coach, when he recruited you, you know, Steve Nash was hosting you on a recruiting visit. They said, man, we couldn't get this dude to say one word. The entire time he was being recruited in his first couple years, we can't have you on our team if you're not willing to talk, because you need to talk to play basketball. Steve Nash hosts you, and he's like, all this guy wants to do is go back and watch his high school, his homecoming football game. He doesn't even want to come to the college and like partake in all the fun of college. So I think by the time you were a senior at Santa Clara, by all accounts, you had kind of come out of your shell or whatever, but it is, you know, I was talking to Steve a little bit over the weekend. He said, I'm just so proud of Lloyd, because I remember we just couldn't get anything out of him for the first year or so he was on campus. Do you ever sit back and say, yeah, I've come kind of a long way socially or whatever?
You know, somewhat. I was pretty shy. I was more reserved and more of an observer as a younger person. And I still am. I don't think I'm shy, but I am very reserved. I am somewhat introverted. I don't like to be loud. I try not to be loud. I'm usually not loud. But I do think, you know, I like to observe before I say something and express how I feel. And, you know, usually when I say something, it's pretty well thought out. I've thought about it well in advance of me just speaking and reacting. So I think the growth, and this is why it's important. And like I said at the beginning, you know, our local media has heard me talk about the maturation and development of our young players being critical, because that's what I went through. You know, when I got to college, when I first entered into college, I was very reserved and quiet. And as Coach talked about, by the time I left, I was very outspoken. And I think you go through these phases where you have to grow up, you have to mature, you have to go through some things. And for me, being in a very academic environment allowed me to mature academically and emotionally to where I could find my voice and use my voice. And our players right now, I just happen to have 21, 20, 22 year olds that are kind of the core of our team. You know, they're learning this. Trey Young is learning this as he's joining with More Than a Vote and being on TV quite often and being a second year all-star and having the media in front of him and having endorsement deals and things of that nature. Well, you start to learn, you can't just be quiet. You got to use your voice because people are paying you. They're expecting you to, and you know, they just think you're the guy. Let's hear from you. So you have to learn how to use your voice comfortably.
Three basketball questions, two about the Hawks and one about a young Lloyd Pierce. And then we will wrap up. Number one, you traded for Clint Capela and Dwayne Dedmon. Is John Collins a full-time power forward now? How is that going to work? He's obviously a devastating north-south rim runner. He can do that a little bit with Dedmon, right? Dedmon can spot up and shoot threes. That was the alignment when you had both of them.
For sure, yeah.
John has improved his three-point shooting and his face-up game. Are you worried at all about have we squeezed him into a role that doesn't quite fit his skills, or is he ready to do anything?
No, I mean, he's shown us that he can shoot the basketball at a pretty high level. And I think that really just expands his game when we play big. And as you're seeing, you know, you go into LA and you play the Lakers, you have to play big. So, you know, it's still comforting to know that we can play him at the four with the five and match up appropriately. And they've got to match up against him because he can pick and pop now. And I think now you're asking big men to come out on the floor and try and chase John around. And that's where his real skill set takes over, is getting behind the defense, finishing at the rim, you know, but being versatile. He will play some small ball five, and we'll be able to get, you know, that core unit of guys and whoever else we add to it, and, you know, be able to switch one through five when we play smaller teams. And, you know, we still have the same advantage where we can put them in pick and rolls, or we can put some smalls in pick and rolls and use John as a space guy, which is what we did with Dwayne the first year. You know, Dwayne was spaced a lot and he shot 39% from three, and John was the guy rolling. Or, you know, we could play smaller pick and rolls with some of our, you know, DeAndre Hunter, and get some threes and ones in the pick and roll and get a one switched on to DeAndre Hunter and just post him up. So
I also thought John improved his post game a little bit this year in terms of his comfort. But if you put a smaller guy on him, he was a little more aggressive, a little more comfortable.
Yeah, we
playing bully ball.
We developed this term where we just said, John, if you get a small, punish them. And that's all he knows. Like, it isn't pass. It isn't look to pass. If they want to play the switch basketball when you're at the four, great. I mean, as soon as it goes in there, just punish them. And then also punish them on offensive rebounds, because now you got a two or a three or a one trying to keep you off the glass. Like, that's a knock on you if you can't come up with the second chance opportunity. So, no, I've got zero concerns of John.
Yeah, you're excited. I can see your your face.
Zero concerns.
The listeners can't see your face. You're excited.
Two guys that are, you know, 60% or probably 70% and above around in the restricted area, and Clint and John for their careers, playing with Trey in a pick and roll. I'm good. I'll take that all day.
Basketball question number two. Trey Young is sometimes accused in the media of having the ball almost too much and quote unquote assist hunting. What do you think of that? And is there a world in which Trey veers his game a little bit more to look like how Steph is running around off the ball a lot and using the gravity of his shooting that way? Or is that just not what he is as a player?
Assist hunting. I'm trying to get him to get more assists.
There you go.
he's understood that for me. He's an unbelievable shot creator, for our guys. And I tell him often, I think you could lead the league in assists. And every game, there's three or four more opportunities that, you know, you may have missed or didn't see that, you know, benefits us all. So I'm trying to get him more assists. In terms of the Steph comparison and the off the ball comparison, I think it's just a natural progression for him to develop that aspect of his game, because it ties in directly to the development of a Cam Reddish and Kevin Herter and whoever else we bring in. You know, having I use the motto of Kyle Lowry and Fred VanVleet, and you go back to when they won the championship in that game seven in the fourth quarter where Fred VanVleet was the guy.
He took
Kawhi was on the court. Kyle was on the court. Fred was the guy, and that really got going. But you can play two point guards. You can play two ball-dominant guys in addition to the most ball-dominant guy on that team, which was Kawhi. You can have multiple guys doing that, but the other guys, when you're not with the basketball, and Trey's going to be without the basketball at times when Cam is rolling, you know, they have to understand how to play that other role, which is off the ball and moving and being hard to defend.
Last question, basketball question. In 2009, Lloyd Pierce is 33 years old. I believe I'm doing my math right.
All right.
Assistant coach with the Cleveland Cavaliers. The Cleveland Cavaliers draft a young bouncy kid with the 30th pick in the draft named Christian Iyengo.
How'd you get this story?
Oh, baby, it's a good one. people in Cleveland are still talking to this day about what Lloyd Pierce did to Christian Iyengo, who was a prolific trash talker, even though he was still learning English, in a one-on-one game shortly after the Cavaliers drafted Mr. Christian Iyengo. Can you please tell the story as you recall it?
You know, the beauty of being in player development is, especially when you're relatively young, is you just get to play basketball every day. And, you know, in Cleveland, we played every day. Myself, Chris Gent, Melvin Hunt, Mike Malone. I mean, we had a crew, and we played as often as we can, and we played with our players. And Christian obviously was a young draft pick, super athletic, full of confidence as he's learning the English language. And, you know, we're playing one-on-one. I think we're just after the workouts, and we continue to play one-on-one, and everybody was just kind of hanging out in the gym, which is what we did. And I went up to finish one time, and I kind of just told him, like, you know, you might get caught. And he kind of looked at me like, psh. And then there, you know, when you got a lot of talkers in the gym, you know, there were a couple coaches that said, Chris, you better watch out. And he just kind of shrugged like, yeah, right. And so one thing that a lot of people don't know is I'm a left-hand dunker. I'm a right-handed player, but I'm a left-hand dunker. And so I set him up with my go-to, and I'm driving my left, and he's just trying to time the steps. And, you know, I was a lot bouncier back then. And so it was a quick dunk. And he had no clue it was coming. And bad timing, because there were a lot of people in the gym. So as soon as you said it, I knew where you were going on that.
It was described to me as Christian and Lloyd were playing one-on-one, and Christian was just talking so much junk, just so much junk. And Lloyd had hit a three from the left, from the wing. I don't remember which
right,
wing.
Right wing. Yeah.
Right wing. And had the ball again. Christian is still talking all sorts of junk. Lloyd pump fakes him, gets him up in the air, gets by him, and Christian catches up because he's faster and more athletic, and Lloyd goes up with a lefty just hammer right on his head, and it was described to me as like it was like Rucker. It was like the gym was like Rucker Park.
It was just
rushing the court and screaming, and that, you know, maybe you ruined Christian Iyengo's career. Maybe that was it for him.
he's still having a pretty good career overseas. You know, the good thing about coaching is you need one moment. You don't need many. You just need one moment with each guy to remind them. And then you can tell the story and you can exaggerate the story even more. So next time I see Christian, it might be two hands, you know, cocked it back, you know, made him fall. I could easily exaggerate it and take it a step further. But no, it's good times.
All right, Coach, you've been generous with your time. You're at the center of it, and it's going to be really interesting and fun to watch you live in that role and see how you live in it. But it's really important, and I've been inspired watching you. And like I said before we did this podcast, we're going to continue this discussion. You're going to come back on here whenever you want and update us and talk about it with us, because it's on all of us to make sure, okay, the NBA started. Let's talk about the X's and O's, right, this and that. Like, you know, it's right on all of us to keep it going. So it's your time. You're generous with your time. You're giving your time, so I appreciate it. And we'll be watching and listening.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And like I told you, I will hold you accountable. This is the point of our platform for players, coaches, the league. I've done a million interviews and podcasts and things of that nature, and it's not for attention for me. It's just my ability and opportunity to keep the conversation alive. And that's why I pose that, you know, challenge. You know, if we're going to do it now, we need to do it later as well. And it's the same thing I've told the assistant coaches to hold their head coaches accountable and further on down the line. So I appreciate you coming on and having me on to talk about this.
Coach, I can't wait to do it again. Please be safe. Enjoy that. Enjoy your wife and your beautiful daughter. Give her a big hug, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you, guys. Appreciate that.
Here's the deal. When it comes to insurance, State Farm sets the bar. They make everything about the process easy. You can manage your coverage, pay your bill, or file a claim from the palm of your hand thanks to the State Farm mobile app, which was awarded Best Insurance Mobile App of 2019. That seems important. They truly care. With 19,000 local agents, they're able to get to know you and provide options that fit your personal needs. But most importantly, you can rely on State Farm to give it to you straight. Just helpful advice, answers you need, when you need them. So when you want the real deal in insurance, go with State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Welcome back to the Low Post Podcast. I guess it's Atlanta Day because joining me now, this is a special thrill for me, 11-year WNBA veteran, two-time WNBA champion, former national champion at the one and only University of Connecticut Huskies basketball team, one-time WNBA All-Star, currently sitting out the WNBA season, Renee Montgomery. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you guys for having me on here.
One of my favorite all-time UConn players to watch. Just a total badass point guard.
Oh, wow. I appreciate that coming from you. That's a big deal because I know you actually watch sports, so I appreciate that.
I try. It's my job. I might as well watch the games.
That's why it's a bigger compliment, because it's actually your job. So for you to say that, like, I'm like, okay, that's lit. And I'm clipping that. I'm taking that with me.
That's what I like to hear. All right. So let's just get to it. You are sitting out the WNBA season to continue your work in social justice. You have a foundation. You just did a Juneteenth event. You have done a lot. You've been at protests and involved in Black Lives Matter. In previous interviews, you have said that the turning point for you when this became sort of a reality that, okay, I might have to step away, was George Floyd and watching that video. So take me inside your thought process. Who's the first person you call or tell to kind of bounce this idea off, like, hey, this has suddenly entered my head. Should I do it? Can I do it? What's the first conversation?
Obviously, like any other human, I called my parents. Like, yeah, I called my parents. I didn't know, you know, what to think. You know, I never even had those thoughts before that basketball wasn't the first thing I'm thinking about. You know, as an athlete, we all know that the whole goal is to win a championship. If you didn't win it the last year, the new goal is to win the championship this year. It's like, it never changes. This Groundhog Day. But for the first time ever, I started thinking about different things and was worried about different things. And so I just told my parents about that.
And what was their response?
They were like, you know, they were sad kind of that this same type of responsibility kind of fell on them, because my mom was a part of walkouts at her high school where, you know, there was a talent show and one of the black students had a lot of pennies thrown at them from the white students at the talent show. So all the other black students, because the staff didn't stop it, they walked out. So my mom was a part of that. So just for her to see that now I'm going to be a part of this same social justice fight, it's almost a sad moment for them.
Well, you talked about that in one of the interviews I read, because your mom, was this in Detroit? Because I know that she was in Detroit in the summer of 67 too, right?
She was young then. So when she was in Detroit, she was young. And then in high school, she was living in West Virginia, which is where I grew up.
Where you're from.
I have all of these probably feelings now.
But you remarked in one of the interviews I read that it was, in a way, depressing for both you and your mom to realize 50 years later.
Exactly.
You know, my daughter now has to do what I was doing, right? I mean, it wasn't just like, yeah, gung ho, let's do it. There was a little bit of like, wow, that's kind of a gut punch, right?
It was a gut punch because she was doing it so that I didn't have to do it. And now when you fast forward and now you see that I'm doing it, for her, it was just kind of like, oh man, like I didn't want this for you. That's why I did the walkouts. That's why I was an activist. So for her, it was almost like, I didn't want this for you, but if you are going to do this, like, here's some advice, here's some things that I saw back then. And she almost became like the mentorship of it.
And you've said, I believe in one interview you said, for now, this is a, you're looking at this as a one season break, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the plan. And the reason I say this is because right now when people ask me, you know, was I excited about the season? I'm not. That's just right now because there's so much going on right now in the communities with social reform that I'm not excited about this current season.
So as you've gotten more involved and read more stuff and just gotten more immersed in some of these issues, is there a pet issue that's sort of that you've found yourself particularly passionate about, or a pet like foundation that you really want to work closely with? Because I heard you with Gino Auriemma, the one that first of all, Gino struggled to figure out Instagram. Is very related. It's very relatable to me. He couldn't log on. The camera was pointing the wrong way. It was just down twice.
I can't even believe they got him on Instagram. So
I enjoyed that as much as the chat. The 5 minutes that it took for Gino to actually get the Instagram hooked up. But I heard you say, you know, one thing that I want to do, because these problems and issues seem so big as to be impossible to tackle, is I want to hone in right in my community in Atlanta. So have you found an issue that's really you want to make your issue?
I think in Atlanta, the main issue I need to focus on is voter suppression. That's the topic that has been global with this last election. You saw the Kumho primetime talking about it. It's a global topic about Atlanta's problem with voting. So I think that would make the most sense for Atlanta. Some other things that's kind of fell in my lap is that multiple companies have been reaching out to start the conversation. So you got to remember, a lot of companies have white management. That's just the facts of it. So now when we're talking about a social racial problem, some of the management doesn't necessarily know how to go about that conversation. So now I'm starting to see that I've been getting booked out for just the conversation starters, having the conversations with companies they want to understand. So that I think could be, you know, we talk about a different laws and stuff, but I'm starting to see that that's where my path is taking me. And it might make the most sense to start having these conversations. So the more people understand at the business level, it can trickle down different to the different reforms.
Did you vote on Tuesday or last Tuesday or whenever it was? And if so, what was your experience like?
Yeah, I did absentee. And that's another thing that people want to have done. Like, that should be an option. There are some older people that maybe can't make it out to the polls. We have to diversify how you can vote. And because of the pandemic, that was an option, you know, but maybe that should be an option moving forward, just period. There should be a certain type of absentee ballot voting that's just available at any time. You know, like there needs to be different ways, because everybody just can't take out a day to go vote.
Well, and they were even talking, I was reading some of the stuff about Georgia's elections a couple days ago, and they were even talking about some of the best trained election workers, and you really need well-trained election workers. And the first time you go vote, you realize, oh my God, this is complicated. And they're older because they've been doing it a long time as volunteers. And if you're 75 years old, you shouldn't be out at a polling place. It's not safe because of the coronavirus. And so they need to deal with that too. Yeah. I'm interested to see, because the real work of all this stuff is invisible, right? And so it's the work behind the scenes in the trenches. And so you talked with Coach Auriemma and some others about sort of by taking a season off, you go from a very visible role, you know, all eyes are going to be on the bubble and basketball and all that, to one behind the scenes. And so it sounds like you got different kinds of advice. Like some people thought, well, I don't know, you're giving up a very visible platform, but you feel comfortable with this way.
I do. And I feel comfortable because I'm giving them a very visible platform, but TV is another very visible platform. So there's already been some things in the work where just because I'm not playing basketball on TV, because that's where people would see me too. So that platform is that platform because games are on TV. So if I'm on TV doing other things, starting the conversation, having the conversation, then I'm not behind the scenes. If I'm talking to businesses, and this is big businesses, some of them are Fortune 500 companies, that's not so much behind the scenes when these are the companies that are contributing to these things. So I think that my effect might come down. Like I see it as like just a trickle effect where it just comes down. You start at the top. Management wants to do better. Like there's some bigger companies where they want to have the conversation. They have employees that wants to see that they want to have the conversation. So I think that these conversations that I'm having with these companies, with these employees, I mean, you never know how big of an effect that could cause.
Well, and also just someone sitting out a season is very unusual. So you immediately find yourself, boom, you're in the news. Everyone's interested. Everyone's curious, right? So it does in a way, for at least the next couple weeks, you're going to have a lot of people reaching out to you because this is a big event. It's just not a lot of people do this for this reason, right?
especially, and this is a topic that, I mean, we've already seen the conversations before I announced that I was sitting out. The only reason I had apprehension is because we've all seen the conversation involving different athletes when they talked about it. So I was like, oh no, I don't know how people are going to receive it. I know why I want to do it. I know what my heart's telling me, but I've already seen those conversations. So now that when I did announce it, you know, I think that it did get a lot of traction because of the pre-conversations. But I do think that the conversation will continue because you will see in the bubble that people will be doing demonstrations, and then that'll circle back to the player outside of the bubble maybe. And I keep saying, I think that there's going to be a continuity. There's a lot of stuff I can't say, but I think there will be some continuity.
Yeah, you're sitting on some stuff. You're sitting on some good stuff.
There will be some continuity inside the bubble and outside the bubble. So that's why I don't think that I'm not giving up my platform. I think a lot of people think that I'm giving up my platform. I think that I'm talking to you guys. My platform is still here. And I think that this will be a conversation that will continue because some athletes inside the bubble want to make sure that people know that they're fighting the cause too.
I have heard that the WNBA players have some meaningful and impactful stuff in the works for what's going to happen in the bubble. And NBA players do as well. Have any NBA players reached out to you since your announcement?
They have. A lot of athletes have, and that's why I was saying, yes, I've talked to some bigger athletes in NBA. And again, I can't like say certain stuff, but that's why I said I think that this is going to work out well, even just the companies. I didn't expect that. You know, I expected different athletes for me to join their campaigns and different things that they're doing, but just the business aspect of it where people are like, yeah, we need to have this conversation. Can you come help us have it? That's what I actually didn't expect. So I think that people will be surprised how many people want to do better.
Well, and the real work, so the real, you know, there was a great story, I think it was in the Washington Post over the weekend, about all of these signs of progress since progress maybe is not the right word, but the Confederate statues being taken down, the chokeholds being banned, police reform, and how it's all accelerated because of this one event, or multiple events, but the George Floyd being the flashpoint, and the involvement of a lot of high-profile people. But behind the scenes, there's been an infrastructure in Black Lives Matter working for years and years and years to sort of be prepared for a moment like this, fighting and fighting and fighting for change and running into roadblocks and running into obstacles, but keeping on going. And without that infrastructure, change is very hard to enact, even when you get a big event like this. And to me, that's what – when I say the real work is invisible, I think the best work happens when the invisible and the visible – meet together. And that's sort of what I think, that's what athletes have a chance to have make happen. Like, that's why I think the NBA players in the bubble, they have a, like, this is the time to go to their owners and say, you want us to play, we want a huge donation to X, Y, and Z, we want a permanent part, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing. And what you said is my exact point for why I said moments equal momentum. Like that, because right now is a perfect storm where people want to listen. Owners have to listen. Companies have to listen, because now employees, players are to the point where it's unacceptable not to. So maybe, like you said, 4 months from now, that might not be the case. And that's exactly why I think right now, while everybody's changing everything, you saw the ban on the Confederate flag. You even see with the NCAA, with Mississippi, they're like, no, we're not going to let that. I mean, without, like, you know, they're not going to let Alabama and different places have Confederate flags and still be a part of the NCAA. Those are wins. And that's what I was telling people right now. Like, we're racking up the wins. And so maybe if there's a player out here that's shining light on different campaigns or different things, or, hey, why don't we have all the states get rid of the chokehold at this point? Like, we've understood that it can happen. So let's everybody get. What if there's somebody that's just banging the drum, you know, right now while everybody's listening?
So WNBA players and female athletes in general have often taken the lead in fighting for social justice. And, you know, you were on the Minnesota Lynx team in 2016 that, after Philando Castile and Alton Sterling wore the shirts to the game that said justice comes with accountability. I can't remember exactly what it said, but essentially a protest shirt, and the Minnesota, four of the police officers working the game walked out because, God forbid, they have to look at a t-shirt for 5 minutes before the game starts. So what a hardship for them. So I'm wondering, take me back to that moment, because I know Maya Moore was involved. I think Lindsay Whalen was involved. What do you remember about hearing about the shirts and the plan? And, like, what do you remember feeling when you walk out knowing we're about to become a big news story?
Well, I remember that they said that they had to have a press conference before the game, kind of explaining what the shirts were about. And I remember thinking that's a little bit odd. It's self-explanatory. Like, our shirts literally said something like, justice starts with accountability. So I thought that was odd initially. And then they further went on, and a lot of fans were really upset with us. Like, wow, you know, we love you girls. We hate to have to choose between you guys. We have military in the family. We're like, what are you guys talking about? Like, we have military in our families too, you know, but people didn't really get what we were talking about. Like, people didn't understand that, you know, that was before Black Lives Matter was a term that was acceptable. You know, we had Black Lives Matter on our shirt. So people were like, well, why are you going against the police department? Why are you going against the cops? Like, they're here to protect you. The whole police, and just so you know, it wasn't just for the whole police department said that they will not be covering our games any longer.
And by the way, that you had on the shirts, I believe, had the Dallas, Texas shield to honor police officers too, who had specifically
so that this didn't happen. So that's why we really thought we went above and beyond to make sure people understand this is just about the Black lives in America right now, that there's an injustice. And even putting a police shield on our shirt, it didn't do anything. Because at that time, look, this is before Colin Kaepernick took a knee. So that was a very unique thing that we were doing, in a sense that nobody had ever even heard of it. And so they were like, what is it, our Minnesota Lynx girls that we love, what are they doing? Like, that was kind of the tone.
I've never understood the notion that, well, when I go to a sporting event, I don't want to see any politics and don't want to see any protests because it ruins my experience of the game. I like, even if you, let's just say you either misunderstand what the point of the shirts or the kneeling is, or you somehow oppose it, which oppose what it stands for. No, understand and oppose it, which seems like, okay, whatever. That seems impossible to me. Like, it really ruins your experience of the game. Like, you can't survive 5 minutes of that and then enjoy the basketball game. I just have never understood. So you remember the fans and the whole police said they're not going to work the game. Did it settle down a little bit after that? Or what do you remember about the reaction, like, a week later or a month later?
I remember Coach Reed talking about how she was proud of us. So even with all of the backlash, you know, we all, like, one of my teammates received, like, a letter from somebody that she actually knew saying, I can't believe you sided with that side. Like, you know, people were receiving backlash. Like, this wasn't just we wore the shirts and it was over. Like, we had some white teammates that were receiving backlash about siding with this side of things. Like, they thought it was almost us versus them, and people started to pick their sides. It was like the cops, military, America, and us. You know, they thought that's what we were protesting. So it was shocking. But I can distinctly remember Glenn Taylor's our owner. There was our owner there in Minnesota, and Coach Reeve. I can remember them saying, like, you know, they're proud of us. Like, despite the fallout that we didn't, you know, we knew that it could happen. That's why they said they were proud of us. So I can remember that, like, wow, that was impressive for us to receive this much backlash and ownership, and the coaches still, like, just stand strong behind us.
Did you, I believe you said no in an interview before, but I wonder if anything's changed since. Have you talked to Maya Moore about your decision to sit out the season?
I have to reach out to her, because everybody's asking that. It's like, we're like those friends that I talked to Mama, I think 4 days before I announced, you know, she hit me up about something. I don't know, but it's interesting because we're like those friends. Even Tina Charles hit me up. We don't have to talk very often, but when we see each other, we all met up for our 10-year reunion earlier this year at UConn. And it was like we never left. It was like we were literally back in college. So I haven't talked to Mama. So I, like, Mama hit me up because people are asking. So I'm going to hit Mama as soon as I get off of here.
Your senior year at UConn, you guys went undefeated, right? Was that your senior year?
That started the streak.
Not bad. Not bad.
No, it was a relief. I was about to be a loser. Everybody is like, how many championships did you get at UConn? I'm like, one. They're like, what?
One is... You got one. That's like, you got the recent the seniors that just graduated, I believe, got zero.
Oh, did they?
Isn't that, I think, or they haven't, I don't know. It's been, they're on a little bit of a cold streak. Well, I mean, Maya has been back in the news because it's interesting how this happens to female athletes, because they don't receive the same media coverage. So all of this is happening. And then there's this spate of stories, and we just had a big one on ESPN last week, like, hey, remember?
Yeah. And I've been
Hey, remember, this woman actually just flat out left in the prime of her career as maybe the best player in her sport and still hasn't come back. And like, maybe she'll come back, maybe not, but that is a remarkable story. And like, sometimes you just have to punch people in the face like, hey, remember this story? This is kind of a crazy story.
I'm the one saying that, because I said, look, she did it. Like, everybody kind of gets why I'm doing it now. We watched that 8 minutes and 46 seconds. People get it. She did it before all that. And yes, there were other police killings and everything like that. But there was something about this George Floyd murder that woke up the world. But she did it 2 years ago. Like, I've been telling people that all along, because they're like, yeah, the first woman to do this. I'm like, well, not technically. I'm the first woman to opt out of this 2020 season. But if we're talking about people that stop playing for social reform, she literally just got a man out of prison. So, I mean, like, that's a big deal. And that's my homie. So I want people to know too that, like, she's doing that. But yeah, she was doing it before it was cool, let's say.
Well, it's still a pretty rare thing that you're doing now. And I'm very curious to sort of hear from you later what your experience is like. So let's stay in touch, because you're going to find, I bet as you go around the grassroots and meet different people, you're going to find a person that you click with, or an organization that you click with, or some cause within a cause that's like, that's where I'm putting all my energy. And like that, that's what I want to hear about as you get deep into it. So I hope we can stay in touch and maybe reconvene in a couple months or something.
For sure, Zach. Thank you for having me.
Renee Montgomery, you're a legend. Please keep up. Enjoy the work. Get some stuff done. We need you. I feel often like these problems are so incalculably huge that I have to quit my job to even begin addressing them. You have actually quit your job for the time being. So good luck, and thank you for a little bit of your time today.
Thank you for having me.